From the studios of 2RPH in Sydney, this is 30 Laps with Dick. I'm Richard Lyon. Welcome. First up, a station announcement. 2RPH would like to invite you to spring into the future with us. Our donation campaign is underway. Please contribute today by calling 02951881. That's 02951881. In business hours, or visit 2rph.org.au/donate. We would greatly appreciate it. Well, we've heard of celebrations, but how about a car worth 12.6 million Australian dollars? Super slick Ronaldo from Juventus FC just ordered a new set of wheels to celebrate the team's title win. Or should I say, yet another title win, to be precise. So let's take a gander at that this week. And while we're on football, how about football boots fit for a king? A Tudor king. The Tudor king. Henry himself. Pass the pill, Your Majesty. Only when you're ready. No supercars in 1525, but you could still put the boot in. Kick it to 30 laps, big fella. If you take 1285 from 1525, you get 240 or 240. So let's look at the 240Z whilst we're in the number neighbourhood. Dats and all, just in a few minutes, at 30 laps this week. Footy players, footy boots and the Z car, Hampton Court to Piedmont, all this week. Ha! You could say we were Turin. Okay, so from the driven.co.nz on the 4th of August 2020, a news flash from Juventus FC. Cristiano Ronaldo celebrates the season with a $14 million Bugatti Sentiodici. And this is by Andrew Slice at driven.co or drive.co.nz. Winning a season title with your own team or with the team that you play in is enough reason to celebrate for any footballer. But Cristiano Ronaldo has really pushed the boat out by adding another extremely exclusive Bugatti to his garage. While exact purchase details remain unclear, when Bugatti pulled the covers off the Sentiodici late last year, the French brand revealed the Chiron-based hypercar would start somewhere between the US $9 million mark. Between, I guess, starting at poverty and going to US $9 million. Anyway, we read on. Ronaldo reportedly ordered the Sentiodici in black and white, which is the same colour scheme that his current team Juventus uses. Unfortunately, Ronaldo will have to wait until 2021 to take delivery. This Sentiodici will join his already packed garage, which features hypercars of all shapes and forms, including two other Bugattis, a Veyron and a Chiron. There was a rumour floating around that Ronaldo purchased Bugatti's $26 million La Voiture Noire, but this has since been disproven. Unveiled as the spiritual successor to Bugatti's iconic EB110, the Sentiodici is powered by an 8-litre quad-turbo W16 engine that pumps out a mind-blowing 1,177 kilowatts and 1,600 newton metres of torque. This allows for 0 to 100 in a time of 2.4 seconds before topping out at a hefty 380 kilometres an hour. Just 10 Sentiodicis were sent to be built over the next year or so, and all were accounted for. Even before Bugatti made the public announcement. If you're after a similar spec Bugatti, the Chiron Supersport would be the next best bet. I don't know. I don't think I could. I want them in a particular colour and they couldn't supply it, so I was out of luck. So thank you to drive.co.nz for that piece of motoring and football history. And talking about footballing history, how about a random football bit of trivia from the interweb? Unsigned, so we don't know who wrote it. Our friend Anonymous, probably. Dr. Maria Haywood, an expert at Southampton University, has discovered that Henry VIII, the Tudor king, who had six wives, owned a pair of football boots. These shoes, costing 4 shillings, approximately 100 quid in today's money, were made by his personal shoemaker, Cornelius Johnson, in 1525. Dr. Haywood found them in a list of the king's clothes made when he died in 1547. Sadly, we don't know what the football boots looked like, so we cannot compare them to those worn by Ronaldo or Beckham or George Best, for that matter. However, it is not likely they were anything like the boots worn today. Historians think they were probably heavier than the normal shoes of the time and made of especially strong leather. They needed to be strong because the football during the 16th century, when Henry VIII was king, was a very tough game. Football, in Tudor times, was a very vicious game, with no teams and no rules, so it was not a game for gentlemen, comments Dr. Haywood. According to a Tudor writer called Sir Thomas Eliot, it was a game of beastly fury and extreme violence. It is known that it was especially popular on Shrove Tuesday, Pancake Tuesday, and Henry VIII even tried to ban the game because it so often led to riots and violence. Behaviour generally appears to have improved over the ages. Yeah, well, that would depend which team you support, I guess. Anyway, that was a random football piece of information from the wonder of the interweb. It's amazing, you know, when you collect music as you go through life, you collect stuff and you think, where the heck am I going to use that? Well, that was from Herman's Hermits and it got a run in one of our shows. How about that? Let's get on to bigger and better things, shall we? And we move to Classic and Sports Car, an article read by Greg McLeman, and how the Datsun 240Z changed motoring forever. And I thought this is probably worth a look, so what has he got to say, Greg? Well, let's find out. Every now and then, a car comes along that turns the automotive world on its head. A model not only tops its class, but widens the gap to its competitors by such a degree that it completely redefines it. All things to all men, the solution to life's ills. Jaguar struck on the secret formula in 1961, creating the E-Type, a car that was perfect blend of stunning good looks and groundbreaking performance. Ford managed the same trick with a Mustang 3 years later, bringing high performance and sleek GT looks to the blue-collar enthusiasts who had hitherto been picked or priced out of buying a car for the sheer enjoyment of it. But while those companies built on a sales legacy stretching back generations, Nissan's achievement was all the more remarkable from having come from comparatively nowhere. The Japanese home run came in 1969 with the Fair Lady Z, sold as the Datsun 240Z, outside its home market, which stole a march on its rivals by combining electrifying pace and fresh good looks with a level of fit and finish that overnight made its contemporaries look like donkey carts. In the crucial US market, the Datsun was so keenly priced that it that to opt for an alternative from the chasing peloton became almost unthinkable. Few could have predicted the next big thing to come out of the land of the rising sun. Until the Zed, the most successful Japanese exports had leaned heavily on Britain's motoring legacy for their inspiration. The cars that resonated most, particularly in America, were the 1600 and 2000 Roadsters, utilitarian machines in the mould of the Sprite and the Midget, a pared-back hangover from the side-screen sports cars of the 1950s. Nissan's beachhead in the UK, meanwhile, was only established in 1968, and its first few years were hampered by crippling import duties and an arrangement to share dealerships with NSU, which left almost immediately which itself was almost immediately overtaken by the Audi. NSU, folks, is the company that builds Daihatsu. Japanese manufacturers have since become the masters at analysing and evaluating the competition to inform their designs. You need look no further than the Mazda MX-5 or the Honda NSX for proof of that. But it was the 240Z that blazed the trail, looking to improve upon rather than emulate the most successful cars from overseas. Nowhere was this more important than the visual styling, which led to Fumio Yoshida and Kumio Tomara to pore over the headline concepts and coupes of the day, notably Toyota's 2000 GT, Jag's E-Type, and even the Ferrari 275 GTB, whose proportions informed the Japanese design from the earliest days of its development. What began as the Albrecht von Goetz-inspired A550X prototype quickly transformed into something very different, an attractive classic coupe with practical dimensions and clean modern lines that spoke more to the 70s than the decade in which it was born. So important was the styling to the project that the clay model was agreed upon before Hitoshi Yomura, Tsuhiro Benitani and Hidami Kamara had the chance to get their teeth into the mechanical elements, with the team subsequently facing a myriad of obstacles to make everything fit. And fit too, for that matter. Oh boy. Anyway, some parts were taken straight off the shelf, with the front suspension, a lateral subframe suspension arm and McPherson strut arrangement being borrowed from the existing 1800 Laurel sedan, which was something we didn't get in Australia as far as I know. Anyway, other components included the rear end, required more thought. In the end, the team opted for Lotus-style lower A-arms and vertical struts located in the luggage area, which offered superb road holding but exposed a lack of tortoiseshell rigidity. Because the brief called for two full-size suitcases to fit in the boot, linking the struts wasn't an option, so the designers went to great lengths to beef up the sills and apply reinforcing plates. Practicality was retained through a strut brace offered as an aftermarket extra. That the 240Z had North America firmly in its sights almost from the point of inception was due in no small part to an impassioned lobbying of Nissan's forward-thinking US chief, Yutaka Katayama. Having spent time in the country, Mr. K was remarkably in tune with the American market and served as a bridge between Tokyo and the United States, helping to steer development in a direction that prepared the car for success abroad. Sadly, this included sidestepping the sublime Prince-developed four-valve triple-carb twin-cam 2-litre S20 engine in favour of something more palatable in the land of the Big Mac and aerosol cheese. The twin cam screamer did find a home in the Skyline GTR and the Japan only quasi racer, the Z432. But the mass market Z instead received the 2.4 litre L24, a muscular straight six with a cubic capacity that wouldn't spook American buyers more accustomed to the big V8s. I guess you could say they had to turn it into something so strong. We'll be right back. Well, it certainly did carry a few people away. There's no doubt about it, the 240Z. Anyhow, back to the show. Few interiors capture the essence of the 70s Grand Tourer in quite the same way as the 240Z. The long doors giving access to the two low-slung vinyl chairs in a cockpit that feels both familiar and comfortable. The tall, shapely seats are reminiscent of those in the Mazda MX-5 and are more accommodating than they look. Road and Track's 6'2" road tester gave the coupe 10 out of 10 for interior comfort in 1970, and it's hard to disagree. The driving position is perfect, giving a superb view of the deep-set instruments in the lavishly moulded dashboard and out over the rakishly dished, dark-stained wooden wheel to the long sculptured bonnet beyond. Values have risen dramatically in the last 10 years, pushing the 240Z from an affordable alternative to a straight six. Brits such as the Triumph GT6 and the MGC GT to a borderline exotic. So the chance to spend a full day with one of the best examples, straight from the heritage collection of its manufacturer, is a rare treat. The Sunshine Yellow car, owned by Nissan UK, has undergone a full restoration in recent years to an exacting standard, with a focus on originality. A few modifications have slipped through the net, however. The first was a racy set of mini light wheels. These were all the rage as an aftermarket upgrade when the Datsun was new, and they look fantastic on this eye-popping classic. The rest of them have got to do with the engine mechanics, and we're not going to go into that today. But anyway, off we go. As well as the intoxicating noise and underbonnet bling that we didn't talk about, the new carbs offer better fueling and should improve the 151 brake horse quoted by Datsun in the period. Itself enough to propel the coupe from rest to 60 in 8 seconds. But slower than your Bugatti. And on to a top speed of 125 miles an hour, a lot slower than the Bugatti. But clearly you can't compare the two. It certainly feels quick enough on the road, with a sharp throttle response beautifully complementing the 2.4-litre Big Six. The Z's designers didn't think that the ostentation explosions were suitable for the concept, so the exhaust noise is relatively muted, which serves only to shine a spotlight on the magical roar from under the bonnet. Steering is something of an enigma in the Z. Original designs called for a caster angle of 6 degrees to aid straight-line stability, but that resulted in nearly twice the steering effect required compared to the Porsche 911. The angle was halved for production, but the helm remained surprisingly weighty at low speeds, only easing up when you're really pressing it on. It isn't long before your hands become sore from the effort of wrestling the wheel left and right. A slightly reluctant and rubbery gear change contributes to the problem. You have to be assured and confident with each ratio, but it's sweet enough and it doesn't mind being hurried. But these quirks are easy to forgive on the undulating back roads of Oxfordshire, a winding network of S-bends, hills and hollows that becomes, for an afternoon at least, your private test track. Pick up the speed and there's a bias towards understeer, but turn in harder and the front end hooks up nicely with surprising little body roll. The steering is a bit fluffy, dead ahead, but like the gearbox, it rewards a firmer hand, responding faithfully when the wheel loads up. Each change of direction is accompanied by a perfectly balanced shift of weight, like a boxer dancing on two toes. A rougher surface and in tighter bends, things become a bit more unsettled, with the scuttle shake you expect from any 60s sports car. But broadly, the suspension does a decent job of keeping all four wheels on the tarmac. Most owners will have upgraded these components to tidy the handling and release the chassis' potential. But even in factory trim, insisted upon by the team at Nissan, the Z carries itself well, absorbing the worst of the bumps while remaining sharp enough for a grin to be planted permanently on your face. If the 240Z has one flaw, its price. Buying a nice one today will set you back the thick end of £30,000. Even more if you want the very best. It's a problem that afflicted the car in period two. Well, at least in this country, and this was written in the UK. To buy a Z in 1970 would cost nearly £2,300, at a time when the MGB GT was less than 1,500 quid, and the Capri just £100 more than that. In Australia, list price was £3,526. It's noteworthy that Datsun sold any at all, let alone the 1,600 it actually shifted. To properly measure the car's success, you have to look at its target market, which was the United States. There, the Datsun represented staggering value at almost half the cost of the Mercedes-Benz 280 SL. If you wanted a homegrown Corvette, you'd have to increase your budget by 50%, even more to go to an E-Type or a 911T. It takes an almost never-ending string of adjectives to sum up the successes of the 240Z. Fast, agile, engaging, comfortable, and beautiful will get you started. But the final and most important is that the most surprising and not one readily associated with such a superb buy is the build and the well-equipped car and the price. Tell them the price, son. Well, today in Australia in 2020, a 1971 240Z with 35,000 original kilometres sold in February for $460,000. Not a bad investment, one might say. So, that's the story of the Datsun 240Z by Greg McLemon, and it was written in June 2020. And it came from Classic and Sports Car magazine. And his name's Leman, not Lemon. I'm sure he'd be upset if I called him Lemon, especially when he's talking about cars. Whether you're with me or not, always take the weather. So today we're going to finish off from the life and leisure section of the Australian Financial Review. And this is going to be written by Tony Davis, just a little piece. Retro chick four-wheel drives hit the road. Retro is in for off-roaders with Ford's reborn Bronco, recently unveiled at the newly formed INEOS Automotive Company, announcing the Grenadier 4x4. The Bronco was an off-road capable SUV-style wagon built in the US between 65 and 96, and, for a while, also assembled in Australia. The newcomer takes many design clues from its forebears. Its rival has attracted huge attention in the United States, so much so that Ford is suggesting Bronco will become a brand rather than a single model. Australians look unlikely to benefit, though, as the Bronco will initially be built in left-hand drive only. There's a better news on the front for the Grenadiers. It's a first-time car maker, and it can bring an all-new model to market in these tough times. Deliveries are promised for Europe in late 21 and for Australia soon after that. At first glance, the Grenadier looks like a superseded Land Rover Defender. On second glance, it looks even more so. It's hardly a coincidence, since Land Rover updated the Defender with a much more modern-looking machine late last year. Interest in the old one seems to have increased enormously. This one, though, uses a new and unique chassis and BMW petrol and diesel engines. INEOS Chairman Sir Jim Ratcliffe says the Grenadier project started by identifying a gap in the market, abandoned by a number of manufacturers, for a utilitarian off-road vehicle. This gave our engineering blueprint for a capable, durable and reliable 4x4 built to handle the world's harshest environments. But it had to look the part as well. INEOS Automotive is backed by INEOS Group, a huge private company focused on petrochemicals. In creating the Grenadier, INEOS will join literally thousands of others, big and small, who have attempted to launch a brand new car. In its favour is it has commissioned as its development partner the highly experienced Magna Steyr, which develops and builds cars for many major manufacturers in Austria. And that was by Tony Davis, a little piece in Life and Leisure magazine from the Australian Financial Review on the 9th of August 2020. And that's where we'll leave it today, I think. We stayed in England most of the time this afternoon. I hope you enjoyed the show. We talked about Ronaldo and his flash new set of wheels. Crikey. And we talked about the great 240Z. And we talked about Henry VIII's football boots. So we've had a pretty diverse sort of a show this afternoon, one way and another. And Tony Davis ended it with a new couple of new things on the four-wheel drive market. Well, one will be here and the other one won't, by the look of it. Diversity, that's what we're after, and that's what we got today. Thanks very much for your company. The show's written and produced in the studios of 2RPH in Sydney. I'm Richard Lyon, and I look forward to bringing you another episode next week. As usual, what that will entail, well, you'll just have to wait and see, eh? Unbuckle your seatbelt, get out of the vehicle for another week. I look forward to welcoming you back into the passenger seat for another rapid 30 minutes of motoring history, motoring lore, motor mouths, anything that flies past or flies in the window that's of interest. And until then, thanks for your company and bye for now.